This is True Crime Psychology and Personality, where we discuss the pathology behind some of the most horrific crimes and those who committed them from a scientifically informed perspective.
I'm Dr. Todd Grande. I have a PhD in counselor education and supervision, and I'm a licensed professional counselor of mental health. Dr. Todd Grande, that's my YouTube channel.
Today's question asks if I can analyze the Shanna Goliar murder case. So first I'll look at the background, then the timeline of the crime and the investigation, and then I'll move to my analysis. David Krupa moved to Omaha, Nebraska in 2012 to manage an auto repair shop. He had recently broken up with his girlfriend, Amy Flora, and was looking to date again. He signed up for a dating site. Shanna Goliar was the first person he met on that site. She also went by the name Liz. He said that she was very pretty, and he was attracted to her right away. He told her that he wanted to see other women, so he didn't want to create an expectation that they were exclusive. As it turns out, of course, Goliar would be bad news. I guess he forgot to check the no homicidal stalker checkbox. I will never understand why this isn't checked by default in these dating apps. 37-year-old Carrie Farver brought her Ford Explorer into the shop that Krupa managed. He said there was a little spark between the two of them. Their relationship got off to a fast start. The couple went to Krupa's apartment after dinner on the first date. Farver told Krupa she didn't want anything serious. He would later say that he felt like he hit the jackpot. When Farver was leaving his apartment, she passed Goliar in the hallway. Goliar had been there to pick up a few things from Krupa's apartment. Farver ended up temporarily moving in to Krupa's apartment because it was closer to where she worked. Now moving to the timeline of the crime and the investigation. On the morning of November 13, 2012, Krupa kissed Farver on his way out the door. He told her he would see her later that evening. Not long after this, he received a text message from her phone, which stated that she wanted to move in together. The couple had already discussed that they were not going to do that. Krupa answered the text and said he was not interested. The next message from Farver's phone came quickly, saying, "Fine, I hate you, I'm dating someone else, and I don't want to see you anymore. Go away." Krupa came home that night and found that Farver was not there. 2 days later, he received more texts with the same type of language. Carrie Farver's mother, Nancy Rainey, started receiving text messages from Farver's phone as well, stating that Farver had found a new job in Kansas. Messages were also sent to Farver's employer and son. We see that there were text messages, emails, and Facebook messages. Rainey tried to call Farver's phone, but there was no answer. After this, she called the police, and they started investigating the disappearance. As this was going on, Krupa kept receiving messages. Many of the messages were threatening and had an angry tone. The majority of the messages mentioned Goliar. Goliar contacted Krupa and said she was receiving messages from Farver as well. She said her garage had been spray painted with a threatening message, and she went so far as to report that to the police. Krupa and Goliar started dating again. A lot of key events in Farver's life were coming and going, like her birthday, and she wasn't there. This raised concerns about what happened to her. Rainey continued getting messages. Many of them had poor grammar, which was inconsistent with Farver's behavior. In addition to messages, Krupa believed that he was being stalked. One time he was sitting in his chair watching TV at night and received a text message that accurately described how he was sitting and what he was wearing. In January of 2013, Krupa found Farver's Ford Explorer in a nearby parking lot. He called the police and they searched the vehicle. They only found one fingerprint. It was on a mint container, but the fingerprint was not in the FBI database. A man called Rainey about 5 months after Farver's disappearance, saying that Farver was at a homeless shelter. Rainey drove there, but could not find her daughter. Farver's son sent a message to Farver's Facebook account with questions designed to figure out if the person leaving the messages was really Farver, like what was his middle name. There was no response. Sometimes Krupa and Goliar would receive messages when they were together, so this made Krupa think that Goliar could not be in on it. In August of 2013, there was a fire at Goliar's house, which killed her cat, snake, and 2 dogs. After this, Krupa bought a pistol It was a 9mm Smith & Wesson. Amy Flora, the ex-girlfriend I mentioned before, the mother of Krupa's two children, also received threatening messages, ostensibly from Farver. The stalking continued. Krupa said that one night when he was with another woman, someone shook the front door handle of his apartment and threw a brick through the window. His place of employment was also vandalized. This takes us to 2015. Farver has not been found, and the police are no closer to finding out who is sending the messages. They weren't sure if Farver was alive or dead. New detectives were assigned to the case. They reviewed the old case files and found a few things that stood out. Even though Farver was supposedly sending messages, there was no activity on her checking account. No one actually heard Farver's voice, and there were no credible sightings. They were perplexed as to why Farver would have such an interest in Golyar. The police believe the two had only come in contact just one time for about 10 seconds. All the people being harassed agreed to provide their phone data to the police. They started going through the messages. Over the course of 3 years, there were somewhere between 25 and 50,000 messages total. The police found some interesting items in the data download from Golyar's phone. She had taken a picture of Farver's Ford Explorer a month before it was discovered by Krupa. Golyar had called Farver 6 times using *67 to hide her number, so she was calling her prior to her disappearance. They found a photo of a woman who'd been tied up. The same photo had been emailed to Krupa. It had been taken with Golyar's phone. They had also found a video of someone walking outside Krupa's apartment. It had been uploaded to YouTube using Farver's account, but the IP address pointed back to Golyar's residence. The police met with Rainey, who told them that right after Farver disappeared, a text message came in saying that Farver had sold her furniture. It asked Rainey to let the buyer into Farver's house to pick up the items. Rainey received a proof of sale. It was a photograph of a check made out to Farver. It was signed by Shanna Golyar. The police were able to match the fingerprint found on the mint container to Golyar. Around this time, Krupa called the police and told them that his pistol was missing. At this point, the police received yet another break in the case. They ran into Golyar at the police station. She was there to file a complaint against Amy Flora. Golyar now claimed that Flora was harassing her. Using the complaint as a pretext, the investigators decided to interview Golyar. She now said that Flora must have been the one sending the messages, and she believed that Flora is the one who took Krupa's gun. Golyar even knew that the missing weapon was a 9mm Smith & Wesson. But when the investigators pressed on this point, she acted like she didn't really know much about the gun. She agreed to let investigators download data from her phone. Now, of course, she allowed that before, but that was much earlier in the investigation, so new data had accumulated on the phone.
Something is creeping, don't follow it down.
Let me introduce you to Barry Clue, an authorized financial advisor from New Zealand and a very special kind of stain on humanity.
He was a very knowledgeable young guy.
He was a registered financial advisor.
Type of guy that was bending over backwards to help you.
Now, you could be forgiven for thinking that Barry sounds like a great guy. And you'd be right. Well, right up until the point when you're wrong.
It was all fictitious.
You stole from my son, who has a disability.
Chris never knew. He died believing that we're all taken care of.
A psychopath is somebody who lacks empathy, acts impulsively. I think there's a strong case that Barry might be all of those things, actually.
To find out how Barry Clue stole over $15 million from 81 victims, subscribe to Clueless, The Long Con. That's Clueless, spelt K-L-O-O-G-H-L-E-S-S.
Hello, this is Gary Chahot welcoming you to check out the French History Podcast. Our main show covers the history of France from the first humans until present. If you liked Mike Duncan's The History of Rome and wanted a similar program covering the land of beauty, culture, and love, we are exactly that. We also host world-renowned scholars who have delivered guest episodes on their specialties, including 18th century pirates, revolutionary booksellers in 20th century Paris, the special friendship between the Marquis de Lafayette and Thomas Jefferson, and numerous others. Learn what you love and listen to the French History Podcast today.
The next day, Goliar called the police and claimed that she was shot when she was walking alone in the park. She said Flora must have done it. The police investigated and realized that Flora was not responsible for the shooting. The download from Goliar's phone revealed a lot of new information. Goliar had an app on her phone that allowed her to schedule when messages were sent. This could explain how the messages arrived when she was with Krupa. She had between 20 and 30 fake email addresses. All of them used a variation of Farver's name. The investigators developed a plan to trick Goliar into giving them information about the murder. They told her that they needed her help to catch Flora, who of course they knew was innocent in this whole mess. They told Goliar to contact Flora and see if Flora would admit involvement. Goliar started sending emails pretending to be Flora. The emails contained details of the murder, including that Farver was stabbed 3 to 4 times and her body was put in a garbage bag. The police pressed for more information as Goliar became frustrated that Flora was not under arrest. She sent more emails saying the murder had taken place in Farver's car. The police searched the vehicle again. This time they found Farver's blood. They had searched it twice before and not found anything but that fingerprint. Goliar was arrested for first-degree murder on December 22, 2016. In 2017, as both the prosecution and the defense were getting ready for trial, Krupa remembered that he had a tablet this whole time that contained a memory card that had once been in Goliar's phone. Among the thousands of deleted images the police were able to recover from that card, there was a photograph of a human foot with a tattoo that matched a tattoo that Farver had. Goliar was convicted and sentenced to life in prison for murder, plus sentenced to 18 to 20 years for arson. She continues to maintain that she is innocent. Now moving to the analysis. Goliar was not a particularly sophisticated criminal, but she was able to escape justice for such a long time due to a combination of circumstances. The crime didn't make any sense. Why would Goliar kill somebody she didn't know? Krupa dated 30 to 40 more women between the time that Farver disappeared and Goliar was arrested. Farver was the only one who disappeared. If the motive was jealousy, why only target one victim? Farver happened to have bipolar disorder. Even though police implied this didn't reduce their effort in the investigation, it seems likely they believed Farver had stopped her medication and her bipolar symptoms returned. Essentially, the bipolar disorder gave the police a reason not to take this case too seriously. If they understood bipolar disorder, they would have understood that it runs in cycles. So if mania explained why Farver was missing and why she was allegedly sending all these messages, then that activity would be limited. The messages would have stopped after the mania stopped. So the police may have used bipolar disorder as a reason not to investigate, but they never actually understood the disorder. Goliar managed to murder Farver and not be seen by anybody. Furthermore, the police somehow missed Farver's blood in her own vehicle, even after searching it twice. Goliar made herself into a convincing victim. She vandalized her own property, killed her own pets in a fire. She sent herself thousands of messages, and she shot herself in the leg. At the same time, this made Farver a suspect. Goliar was able to remove suspicion from herself and place it on her victim. As it turns out, this was an incredibly effective strategy. The police said that it took Goliar about 40 to 50 hours a week to send all those messages. So it was like an entirely separate full-time job for her. Krupa did not tell the police about the memory card until the trial was getting ready to start. It would have been helpful to have that information earlier. There were also several errors in logic that helped Goliar to get away for so long. For example, Krupa said he could not remember how many times he changed his phone number, yet the messages did not stop. It never occurred to the police to run an experiment to give Krupa a new phone number that no one else knew, and then have him reveal it to just one person and see if the messages start again. If Farver had been alive, how would she know what Krupa's new phone numbers were? I wonder if these officers went to the Frank Drebin School of Police Investigation. Jealousy as the motive for homicide is not uncommon, but the assumption of a victim's identity is what makes this case highly unusual. Sometimes what we see in murder cases is that the perpetrator will do something to throw off the police timeline, like send a text message from the victim's phone, making it seem as though the victim was alive during a time when the police theorized the victim was already dead. Goliar's efforts exceeded what was necessary to deflect suspicion in this way. She heavily invested in the idea of assuming Farver's identity and then churned that identity into a weapon so she could express her rage. She channeled her dark side through this identity, unrestricted by the law or common sense. Farver's identity became like a ghost, manipulated by Goliar. It was without form. It could not be seen. It could not be captured. Goliar was able to harass all these people and remain undetected. It was a way that Goliar could say anything she wanted. Goliar was not satisfied with simply killing Farver. She wanted to destroy Farver and anyone who was close to Farver. She wanted everyone who knew Farver to regret ever being associated with her. This was an attempt at complete domination. Another angle in this case is possessiveness. Goliar thought she could restore this relationship with Krupa by eliminating the competition. As it turns out, though, Krupa simply dated too many women for Goliar to have kept up. She couldn't have killed all those women, so she took Farver's identity and, again, weaponized it. Goliar was trying to find romance by playing the victim, a desperate strategy that is rarely successful. What really stands out as not making sense is that at some point Goliar had to realize that she wasn't going to be with Krupa, yet she continued to send the messages. She also tried to frame an innocent person, Amy Flora. It's like she just couldn't let it go. It was almost as if there was something addictive about being a victim. It took appearing like a victim even more to get the same high. Again, she moved to arson and then shooting herself when she could have just walked away after committing the homicide. It's unlikely she ever would have been arrested. Goliar's lack of empathy extended to her lack of understanding of what was reasonable for other people to believe. For example, by trying to refocus the blame on Amy Flora, Goliar really made the theory of the crime unnecessarily complex and attracted suspicion. I was waiting for her to say that Flora was really Farver in a disguise, like a Scooby-Doo episode. Goliar did not understand how other people viewed her claims. What type of personality is consistent with this behavior? Here we see a dangerous combination of traits. Goliar was a business owner. She seemed to function well in society in many ways. People who knew her didn't seem to notice anything unusual. It's not like she stood out as psychopathic or detached from reality. At the same time, she was able to murder a woman and assume her identity. With that in mind, her potential personality profile would be something like this. High in openness to experience, she was creative, she wrote all those messages. We see mostly high conscientiousness. She was organized enough to commit murder and not be caught. We see she was extroverted, she was outgoing, assertive, and sensation-seeking. She may have had low agreeableness, she was not empathic and not straightforward. And we see mid-range to high neuroticism. She was unable to resist temptation and angry. Some have theorized that Goliar may have had something like psychopathy. For example, we see that she was manipulative, there was pathological lying, she was able to lie for years, and really she still maintains that, even in prison. We see a failure to accept responsibility, she still has not admitted guilt, and of course the callousness, not only indicated by Farver's murder, but the idea that Goliar killed her own pets. So we see that psychopathy could be a possibility. She also could have been narcissistic. She believed she was entitled to kill and harass. I think what's so frightening about this case is that before the homicide, Goliar and Farver only saw each other one time for about 10 seconds, as I mentioned. It's hard to imagine that a person like Goliar, who appears unremarkable, she didn't stand out for any negative reason, could take that encounter as an impetus for homicide and years of deception. The lesson learned in this case: don't underestimate the power of jealousy to unlock the hidden potential for destruction.
This has been True Crime Psychology and Personality from Ars Longa Media. This content is for educational and entertainment purposes only. Ars Longa, Vita Brevis.
On the morning of August 1st, 1966, shots ring out from the observation deck of the clock tower on the University of Texas campus. It marks the infamous beginning of the modern era of mass shootings in America.
You're listening to Stop the Killing podcast. Join us as we take you behind the crime scene tape to explain global mass shootings and mass attacks. I'm Sarah Ferris, but more importantly, this is Catherine Schweit, the former head of the FBI's active shooter program.
I spent 5 years as the FBI's top executive looking for answers to the mass shooting crisis. I've been at the shooting scenes. I've traced heroic acts of bravery. And I've sat silently and listened to the heart-wrenching stories from survivors.
Amongst this horror, there is hope. We all hold the key to stop the killing. You just need to know how to unlock the door. Download Stop the Killing and be part of the solution. Search Stop the Killing on Apple, Spotify, and all the usual suspects.